Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Elevating the Sparks, exploring the world of Hasidut. It's a pleasure to learn with all of you tonight. We took a bit of a hiatus, but I'm glad to be back together. And please God, hopefully we'll continue through the summer and we'll explore some important and enlightening and inspiring concepts together. So today I want to tackle a tough topic, which from a bit of more of a historical topic. And that is not just about Hasidut, but the way that it was received, and not just by proponents of the movement, but by opponents of the movement. So we've been learning together, many of us, about Hasidus over the last few months or so. We learned about what sort of caused the movement, what historical circumstances it was responding to. We learned about some of the important leaders at the beginning of the movement, primarily the Baal Shem Tov, Yisrael ben Elazar and his students. We learned about two of them who are really fundamental players in spreading the Torah of Hasidus, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Polonoye, who was really responsible for disseminating in writing the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov, and also the Maggid of Mezrich, who was responsible not as much in writing down the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov, but in orally teaching the ideas and the philosophies of the Baal Shem Tov and spreading them throughout Europe. He was someone who had many very prominent disciples, such as the Shner Zamra Laidi, who we'll hear about more today, who was the beginning of the Chabad Hasidus, Rav Levi Yitzchak of Bardichev, also very well known, and many others. And we've been learning about some of their ideas and their life and their philosophy. So I'm going to go on a limb here, and I'd like to ask you, what have we learned so far? What main ideas or main focuses have we been discussing? What does Hasidus stand for? You want to share something with me? A very basic idea. I know that's intimidating. Who wants me to ask my name? Tell me a little something that Hasidus would emphasize. Marta wants to go.
Emotion over logic.
Emotion over logic. I don't like that so much. But let's say emotional connection to God. Fine. Good. That's a good one. I mean, we've learned, I argued in the first year, and I think this is really the main idea of Thrasa Hasidus. I had to announce it, or rather summarize it in one sentence, is that it's the immanence of God. The immanence of God. Hashem is everywhere, encompasses everything. And that is something that is not just a philosophical concept, but that is meant to define everything we do. God's always accessible. He's always there. If your mind is in the right place, you can always connect to him. And it's all about connecting to him. It's all about forging that very strong, vibrant, emotional, intellectual connection to God in every single thing that we do, for everything that we do, for every single person. Every person, whether they're learned, not learned, whether they're at the top of society, they're not at the top of society, anyone can connect to God at all times because he's right there. Whether you're at a happy time or a sad time, a difficult time or an easy time, it is always an opportunity to connect to Hashem. That, I would say, is the main message of Hasidus, which was one that really struck a chord with a lot of people. They really resonated with it. That was something that was the sort of message they wanted to hear at that time in Jewish history, where things were not always so easy and they felt left behind by the rest of society. And specifically, beyond, and we talked about how that happens through connecting to this sort of higher realm of existence, that this physical world that we live in is not the be end all and end all of existence. But there is a higher spiritual realm that we can connect to, that we can transcend this world. And that's the real world, in a sense. That's reality. And the physical world is just an illusion. And part of what Hasidus preaches is about trying to transcend that illusion, to connect to God and transcend our physical boundaries and to ascend to where God is. And one way of doing that we discussed is through the tzaddik, through the Rebbe. That the Rebbe has this sort of unique connection with God, this unique soul, and is totally steeped in Torah and mitzvos and davening and prayer. And through forging connection with him, he is a channel of divine influence. And the Rebbe shouldn't be someone who just sort of isolates himself. He has to be someone who helps his followers connect. So all of these are ideas that were percolating in the world of Hasidus. So it all sounds good, no? All sounds good. Connection to God for everybody. What could be bad? Certainly everyone must have been for that message, right? Not so much. Not so much. Indeed, there was a very fierce opposition to the Hasidic movement, a very fierce opposition. And what I'd like to do with you during the course of tonight's class is to learn a little bit and reflect a little bit about what caused this opposition. I don't think it's just history. I think it is also very relevant to our lives today. So with that, I am going to share my source sheet with you, or my PowerPoint, and we will begin. Hope you like my first page over here. It's you see, it's called Elevating the Sparks, so you see some sparks and such. Very nice. Okay, the spread of Hasidus. We've spoken about this. Again, sort of get this historical context, the Hasidic movement, which was the philosophy of the Baal Shem Tov and his students, really spread throughout Europe in the second half of the 18th century. And during the Baal Shem Tov's life himself, it was pretty unopposed. He received relatively little opposition, whether that was because it hadn't had as much widespread influence as it did later, or that's because of the Baal Shem Tov's figure in and of himself, maybe because he was one sort of unopposed leader of the movement. He was sort of able to rein everyone in a certain way. During the Baal Shem Tov's life, things were pretty smooth, I guess you could say. But soon after he died, after 1760, already by the time the Maggid of Mezrich, his student, took over the movement, it began to really generate a lot of opposition. A lot of people and very important rabbinic leaders, as we'll see, were very vehemently opposed. This might have been caused, there was a certain character of named Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, who started off as a classical member of the Lithuanian rabbinic establishment and became influenced by the Maggid of Mezrich and his teachings. And one theory is that once the other Rabbanim of Vilna got wind of this new influence on one of their students, they became very suspicious of this movement. Be that as it may, things really began to change in the latter half of the 18th century. And here I have a quote. The truth is I pretty much pulled it from Wikipedia. It's my translation. You can find it there. It's in Hebrew there. But in 1772, the Vilna Gaon signed a letter along with many other of the Rabbanim in Vilna, because there were some Hasidim in Vilna they were very opposed to. In fact, I'll also mention one of the stories told is that there was a certain Reb Chaim of Vilna who became a Hasid, and he started saying potentially disparaging things about the Vilna Gaon, and that might have led to this. So he signed a letter along with many of the other rabbinic establishment, essentially banning Hasidus. Now, before we get to what's in this letter, I want to hear your thoughts about it and what you think it might be referring to. Let's talk a little bit about the Vilna Gaon. Do we know who the Vilna Gaon was? Rav Eliyahu of Vilna? Yes, no? Thumbs up if you do. Have you heard of the Vilna Gaon? So I don't know if we have like we don't have a parallel to the Vilna Gaon in our day and age. The Vilna Gaon was just a wonder. And that's what makes it such a formidable attack. The Vilna Gaon was the undisputed Gadol Hador, the greatest Torah scholar of his generation, par excellence, paralleled by none. This was someone who had memorized Shas, tradition has it, by the age of nine. The age of nine, right? So most ninth graders, might be learning addition or subtraction. He had memorized shas by the age of 9. This was a person who was a master in every single element of Torah. And not just them, he knew it all by heart, whether it was Torah Shebaal Peh and Tanakh, whether it was the Talmud, whether it was the Shulchan Aruch, whether it was all the works of Kabbalah, he had them on his fingertips. And he spent every living moment of his day, almost 24 hours a day, engaged in Torah study. This was a man who spent all day by himself learning Torah, who barely took a minute to have a morsel of bread. And so he was the undisputed angel, Torah personality of his time. And so when the Vilna Gaon was not one to involve himself in public affairs. He was an ascetic. He was someone who was apart from the community. He was essentially supported by the community so that he could just learn in solitude. That was essentially his life. And when the Vilna Gaon went out of his way to oppose a movement, then you can imagine the impact that must have had on that movement. So this is an excerpt from the letter signed by the Vilna Gaon against the Hasidim, essentially putting them in Cherem. Cherem was a very powerful tool in those days. Cherem means excommunication. Now, today's day and age, we have Cherem. It might not be quite as powerful, you know, like we don't live in the same social environment. But in those days, the community had a lot of power. You only lived in the community. All your contacts were your tools to succeed in life. And so excommunication by the community, being isolated socially, communally from all the institutions, was a very powerful thing. And they signed a letter of cherem against the Hasidim. And here's what it writes. And I'd like to think about this, and I'd like to hear what you think each of these things mean. It says, "Our brethren, the house of Israel, you know, newcomers, i.e. the Hasidim, have arrived recently that our ancestors never imagined." That borrows on a line from Parshat Ha'azinu. It says, "Lo si'arum avotechem." And by the way, in Ha'azinu, it means there are gods their forefathers never imagined, actually referring to idolatry. So it's a pretty strong accusation. So that our ancestors never imagined, who formed the cult of chashudim, of suspects, and make associations for themselves, and their laws differ from all the people of Israel in their prayers. That's also a quote from the Megillah, by the way. Datehem shonot mikolam. So their laws of prayer are different from everyone else. They make their own associations, and their laws of prayer differ from everybody else. And they also roar in their Amidah ugly foreign words and act with bewilderment, right? So there's some sort of accusation about the way they pray. There's roaring going on. They're roaring out weird words. And they say that their thoughts wander in all worlds. They claim while they're doing this, they're all sorts of lofty places. They completely cancel Talmud Torah. And in their mouths, they constantly proclaim they will decrease their learning and not be very sorry for transgressions that have come to them. We have already uprooted this evil thought from our place. And just as we have uprooted from this place, so will we uproot from all places. So what I'd like to do, take a look at this little excerpt from this letter. There are other letters. There were a few letters of cherem. In fact, the Vilna Gaon did this no less than 3 times. Issued a cherem in his lifetime. Issued a cherem against the Hasidim. There was one time there was a rumor that he had rescinded his excommunication of the Hasidim, and then he sent an additional letter to the community of Minsk, reiterating that he was still against the Hasidim. So what sort of accusations do you see from this excerpt? What are they angry at the Hasidim for doing? Generally, what do you see here? What sorts of things are the Hasidim doing that the Vilna Gaon and those who signed this letter are opposed to, are objecting to? Very generally, what are they doing wrong? Go for it.
Their prayers are different.
The prayers are different. What do you think that means? Give a guess. How are their prayers different? Well, think about this. More, we're a good answer, right?
Probably more rooted in song and dance and stuff like that.
So Linda says rooted in song and dance. You see that a little bit, right? Because it says they're yelling in the middle of Shemona Esrei. Yelling in the middle of Shemona Esrei. Oh, my goodness, right? So you can imagine some sort of, you know, ecstatic moaning or yelling during Shemona Esrei, and that's not right. Shemona Esrei is supposed to be silent, and what are they doing? Okay. But let me ask you another question. We here in Toronto have all sorts of different shuls. What sorts of shuls do we have? You say? Within the Orthodox world, in terms of Nusach. Give me a few options here. Toronto, you go to a typical shul. What can you expect? What sort of shul are they going to have?
Ashkenaz, Sephardi.
Well, there's a lot of Sephardi in Toronto. Right. I found that almost all the shuls in Toronto are on Nusach Sephardi. Does anyone else find this? A lot of Nusach Sephardi going on in Toronto. Even though not everybody walking around is sort of Hasidish. Well, that was a new thing. The reason it's called Sephardi, although it has some resemblance to Ashkenaz also, is because it's a combination, right? Where does the combination start? So it starts with the Arizal of Yitzhak Luria, a generation earlier, which we'll get to. But the Hasidim were the ones who popularized davening Nusach Sephardi. They took the innovations of the Ari, certain innovations like Berachat Kohanim every day, which we don't necessarily find, or certain additional words in the Shemona Esrei, or certain customs from the Sephardim, they incorporate them into the Ashkenazic liturgy. So they changed the liturgy. So that's part of it, davening. Maybe they're yelling. What else do you see here? What other important Torah institutions do you see being questioned here?
Not learning enough Torah. Like before this, it was Torah. Right. Yeah.
Not learning enough Torah. Bittul Torah. They're canceling Talmud Torah. Right? And that's another. So we'll have to see where does all this come from? And another point I want to make, which Alan also alluded to, they have their own sorts of prayers, right? Well, it's not just about the fact they changed the Nusach. What does it also mean? You have an Ashkenaz minion and have a Sephard minion. Meaning, if you start your own minion, what does that mean? If you're starting a new minion, what does it mean? It means you break away from the old minion, right? It's a breakaway minion, a lot of them. So that, you can imagine, wasn't taken so enthusiastically. So now let's begin a little bit here. Now I wanted to show you just a few examples here that this was no laughing matter. There were real ramifications. This was a very, very bitter dispute between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. Misnagid, or Mitznagid, means someone who is opposed. It's a way of referring to the Lithuanian rabbinic establishment and their followers who were opposed to the Hasidim. And there were real ramifications to this. There were rabbis like Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev and Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polonnaya who became big Hasidic masters, but were also just rabbis. They had already achieved their rabbinic posts beforehand, and they were forced out of their positions due to their adherence to the ways of Hasidus. They kicked them out of their communities. Rishner Zalman Vlaedi, and this is a big theme in Chabad, and there's a lot of emphasis placed on this. The first Rabbi of Chabad, the Baal HaTanya, was imprisoned. He was put into prison because those Misnagdim slandered him to the Russian authorities against that he was rebelling against the government, and he was literally thrown in prison. That is a pretty extreme measure to take. We're not just talking about yelling at each other in shul over something like, you know, whether we should sit or stand for Chazaras HaShatz here. This is real serious stuff. We're talking about excommunications of people losing their jobs.
Hara.
Okay, so obviously the Vilna Gra thought that it was founded. But yeah, that was Lashon Hara about Rishner Zalman Vlaedi. So where does this come from? What are they so angry about? So here I'm going to borrow from, I meant to write the title. It's a wonderful book that I've been reading by Dr. Rachel Elior about Hasidut. And she outlines, page 94 of her book, I have to get the exact title, I'm actually forgetting it, I apologize for that. But she, I think it's called The Mystical Orange of Hasidus. So she outlined five general headings to the objections to the Hasidus, the Vilna Gaon had. So we've gone through some of them, let's talk about each of them. So the first is, you see, and again, there were a lot of different letters, there was a literature to this, there were pamphlets that were comprised objecting to Hasidus. And by the way, I want to mention that it's not like the Hasidim took this lightly. There is a lot, there's a well-known story, and it's not clear exactly what happened, but Rav Shneur Zalman of Laedi and Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, two great Hasidic grandmasters, students of the Magen of Mezrich, went to try to visit the Vilna Gaon in Vilna to try to communicate with him and try to solve this dispute, try to make peace with one another. And as they tell it, the Vilna Gaon refused to see them. Now, in Chabad tradition, in Hasidic tradition, he refused to see them because he was afraid that they would convince him that they were not in the wrong, and so he ran away. And there was a whole, literature and stories told about how the showdown between the Chabad and Rishner Zalman of Laedi and the Vilna Gaon in the Chabad lore, about what exactly happened. In fact, I saw that Ephraim Goldberg has a great PowerPoint on this, and he quotes from the Rav. The Rav had a, Yasha Ber Soloveitchik had a Mesorah that the Vilna Gaon was afraid that he would have to stop the dispute if the Balatanya actually met him. So that's why he didn't want to see him. Well, that's an interesting tradition. But it's not, they didn't take this lightly. They wanted to make peace. It didn't work. And so she outlined, Dr. Elior, five main points of dispute. Let's go through them. One of those is what I mentioned. The Hasidim began popularizing Nusach Ha'ari, the Siddur of the Arizal. And they made adjustments to prayer, to the Ashkenazic prayer book. And if you look at a Sephardic, Nusa Sephardic Siddur, there are different additional words. And some of them really seem like they're more mystical. They're meant to connect you to a higher realm. So things like, Kile Yeshuatcha Kivinu Kol Hayom Mitzapim Li Yeshua, right? That we wait for God's salvation all day. And then we add the words, Mitzapim Li Yeshua. And we're always waiting for the salvation. Sort of a little bit repetitious. Or, Av HaRachaman Shema Kolenu. Father of mercy, listen to our voice. Instead of just Shema Kolenu. So new additions to the Siddur. That's one thing they did. They changed the Nusach. And changing the Nusach is a big deal. Change the Nusach. What are you? You're just changing the Siddur? You've had the Siddur for a long time. This is a tradition. One point. Another point, it was changing ritual, right? So not just the words of the Siddur, but what's done. So wearing your Beinu Tam Tefillin. Anybody know anybody wears two pairs of tefillin? Right? Anyone ever seen that? People who switch tefillin, that's what Hasidim actually do this. They switch their tefillin in the middle of davening. In fact, some might even wear two pairs at the same time. But this was something that wasn't typically done by your average person. And the Hasidim started doing it. They started wearing two pairs of tefillin. Or wearing tefillin at mincha. Generally, our custom nowadays is, although there is a mitzvah to wear tefillin all day, we men don't wear tefillin all day normally because we don't know that we can maintain the standards of physical cleanliness and mental purity for an entire day. So you only wear it at shacharit. So they started wearing it at mincha too. That's in terms of changes in ritual. Three. The third one, it shouldn't be ritual, it should be halacha. That was a typo. But they had stricter standards in certain areas of ritual law. So shchita, this was a big one. The Hasidim all of a sudden demanded a higher standard of shechita. They wanted stricter standards. They wanted sharper knives. And so they started doing their own shechitas. They started doing their own shechitas. I don't want that. They didn't get the regular shechita. They wanted only chassidish shechita. Someone wants to make a point? Okay.
I have a question. Didn't the Vilna Gaon ever hear of the Baal Shem Tov? I mean, he should have respected the fact that his students are the ones that are...
maybe we'll get to that. So I think what you're raising is... Movement, for you're almost like, I understand what you're saying, 100%. So the one part of the big question is, who is the rabbinic authority? Who qualifies as a rabbinic authority? And where does rabbinic authority come from? And that's a really important question here, right? So we're going to get to that. But let's continue going through the different objections. Number four might be a little more fundamental, less specific, spiritual priorities, right? So what's important? What should we focus on? So here you see there are two sorts of general, common topics that are discussed. One is Kabbalah. This is a very big one. The study of Kabbalah or mystical Sfarim, more moral, ethical Sfarim, as opposed to, let's say, Gemara or Halacha or traditional learning. That one of the things that Baal Shem Tov did was to popularize the study of Kabbalah in a certain sense, and particularly the practice of certain rituals based in Kabbalah. The spread of mysticism, that God is always there, that you have to have kavana when saying God's name in a certain way. You have to have kavana to unlock the sparks of godliness and everything. That sort of mystical orientation that was now spread beyond a few people to the general public. That was one thing that was objected to. And the other one is what the primacy of Talmud Torah, which we'll get to in number five, and that is about what should we be spending our time doing and how much time should be dedicated toward learning Torah, or how much time should be dedicated toward davening for a very, very long time. Right, so when we reference at the beginning of the this letter over here, where they say that they talk about how they're going to be mevatel Torah, so when it says that they proclaim they're going to decrease their learning and not be very sorry, so part of that might be, it's not that they're saying they're going to be mevatel Torah, but they're very clear and open about their willingness to daven for very long periods of time, which obviously, by definition, means you're going to have less time to learn if you're spending so much time davening. Number five, contempt for the Torah and its scholars. Now, this is what I want we should think about for a second. The accusation here is that the Hasidim, the followers of the Baal Shem Tov, do not appropriately respect and even have contempt for the traditional rabbinic establishment. They don't respect the Gedolim enough. And number six, and this is the most extreme subversive activity, they're accused of heresy, which we'll get to in a bit, and also Shabbateanism, which they're accused of being followers of Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi, whom we'll talk about toward the end a little bit more, but Shabtai Tzvi was a false messiah in the era right before the dawn of Hasidus, who claimed to be Messiah, got a whole big following, had some very, very problematic practices, and then ultimately converted to Islam. So Shabbateanism was a huge disaster, frankly, and tragedy for the Jewish community. And there is an accusation here, and this wasn't only for Hasidim, but it was also for Hasidim. There's an accusation here that the Hasidim are closet Sabbateans.
Rabbi?
Let's unpack these a bit. And I want to hear your point, Charlie. But let's talk about, looking at these six things, Which of these do you think is a legitimate problem, or which of these can you imagine being bothered by? What do you want to say, Charlie?
Well, I was going to say that number six to me sounds like an illegitimate thing.
Right. Okay.
All right. And parts of it, I think, is leading to the left on these other five, and parts of it is leading to the right.
Right. Exactly. I mean, you're saying they're being more strict. What could be wrong with being more strict about Shita? Or frankly, being more strict, they may be some Hasidim fasted more often. What could be so bad about that? Right? That's what you're saying, which is a great point. In terms of your point that this number six is illegitimate, you're not necessarily, there's a lot of evidence to say that's true. And there is no good evidence that the Hasidim were Sabbateans. There is no good evidence for that. We'll explain maybe where that suspicion came from. But you're right. There is no good evidence that the Hasidim were Sabbateans. They did not see themselves in this way at all. They did not see themselves as halachic revolutionaries in any sense of the term. So that's really not how they saw themselves, and they were not Sabbateans, but that's a good point. Let's go through some of these, okay? Let's take Charlie's point. What could be so bad about wearing two pairs of tefillin?
Nothing.
Again, you know, assuming there's no prohibition against it, you wear your Rashi tefillin, and in case Rashi's wrong, right, there's two opinions as to the right way to order the parshiyot of tefillin. There's Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Most people wear Rashi tefillin. Some people wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. And so you wear both. What could be bad? What's wrong with that? Or let's say stricter standards for Shnita. What's so bad about having sharper knives for Shnita? Why would they be opposed to such a thing? They're being more machmir.
Isn't that considered all
machmir has sometimes connotations of Loso Sifu, right?
Okay, so I don't think it's Baltosif. There would be an interesting discussion if you wore two pairs of film at the same time, so then maybe we could talk about Baltosif, but let's say they're not doing that for argument's sake. Let's say they wore them at separate times. But let's think about this. If all of a sudden a new sect comes along and introduces new stringencies, what might be challenging about that? Think about it on a social level.
Well, rabbinic authority. Question of rabbinic authority.
Right. Well, number one, it's a question of rabbinic authority.
Rabbinic authority to do it.
Do they have the rabbinic authority to do it? But they're being machmir. But what does it say about everybody else? Whenever you have a new movement, by definition, there's a tendency to say either you're in or you're out. Right? And so there's a new movement, they're doing new shechita. Well, what are they saying? Our shechita is not good enough. Our shechita isn't good enough. You can't use the community shechita. You need your own shechita.
Rabbi, today we have glut kosher and glut kosher.
Yeah, well, things are different today, but this was a new thing, right? So that's true. That's true. We do have that.
A category of los is gotta do. Don't make yourself individual thing. Groups.
Right. So los discordo is not a bad point.
They're dividing the community.
Right. Well, that's a big thing, dividing the community. Exactly. It's separatism. What do you think? You're better than us. You need your own shochet. You're going to start. And there's another idea here also. Rabbinic authority is a very important point, and that's going to get to number five. But sort of number four relates to this too. That there are certain things that you'll find in halacha where we say it's for someone who is, careful people, pious individuals can do X, pious individuals do Z, right? And if you're not one of those individuals, so then... Yeah, it's considered yuhara. It's considered haughty or arrogant to take on certain practices, like wearing tefillin all day is a perfect example. It's considered yuhara to wear tefillin all day. And all of a sudden, they start wearing tefillin more often. Who do these people think they are? They're so holy. They're worthy wearing tefillin, and particularly with Kabbalah, particularly with the study of Kabbalah. Who says that any average Joe can just pick up the Zohar or even do something based on the Zohar? Who are you? Who are you to do that? It's not something that's done. This is something that's meant for the Yechidei Segula, the unique people and pious individuals in community. So that's also a critique here. And that relates to 5 and 6. We mentioned authority. If you're saying that we're following, we're not going to go to the shul anymore with the rabbi of the shul, the rabbi of the town, because we have a new rebbe. We have Rabbi Yitzchak Berditchev. He's my rabbi. And there's something special about Rabbi Yitzchak Berditchev. He's so out, he's so there for the community. He's there for me, and he's so spiritual, and he connects me. And I want Rabbi Yitzchak is my rebbe. You know, I'm going to follow the Maggid of Mezrich. I'm going to follow Shneur Zalman of Leidy or Shmuel Shmelka of Nicholsburg or all the other Hasidic rabbis. All of a sudden, there's a new form of religious leadership that is different, that is more mystical, that's involved in helping the community in a different way and connecting them to something greater, and that's supposed to have these sort of mystical powers. And what about the rabbinic establishment? So that's interpreted as, I guess, they don't think we're not good enough for them. And that's seen as an affront, the fact that they're making their own innovations and they're taking on certain customs without approval from the rabbinic establishment, from the rabbi of the town, and they're following these other leaders, is seen as an affront to the rabbis who already existed, which then, and we'll get to point 6 in a second, that has to do also with this focus on Kabbalah. So the point being, there was a certain revolution that was happening on a religious level, but also on a social level. I think I can get my charger for a second, so I'm going to run out of battery. Bear with me for 1 second. I apologize. Okay, right over here. I am here. Just going to plug in. Hopefully I beat the buzzer and we will continue. Ah, good. Okay. So this was seen as a challenge to the rabbinic establishment. It was a social movement. It was a set. They have their own group and they're separating from the community. And again, it's a lot different than it was today, where you have like a million shuls all over the place. And we're sort of, you know, we live not in an isolated community, but we live amongst all sorts of different sorts of people. It wasn't that way in those days. So, you know, a separatist sort of movement was a real social revolution. And they felt that it was a challenge to traditional rabbinic authority. So let me just talk for a little bit, and I'll get to you.
Rob, I'm wondering something. Why wasn't this an issue at the time of the Ariya when he was around? Propagating his teachings. Why didn't they take the same offense?
So that was the Hasidim's claim. So all of these challenges, what did the Hasidim say? So there were a number of points. They felt that they were in their rights making these changes, these modifications. And the truth is, some of them were less innocent than others. There were certain somersaults happening during davening that are mentioned. I'm not exactly sure what's behind those. There's some Kabbalistic idea to it. Maybe there are certain areas of halacha which were slightly less appropriately maintained, such as zmanei tefillah, davening times. So there are certain innovations made, but the Hasidim felt like they were in their rights making these innovations for two reasons. Number one, they weren't really new. They came from the Ari. There were certain mystical societies that existed before the Hasidim. The Kabbalists of the Ari and the bit of Rav Yosef Karo, even afterward, there were what we were called Klois, which were a certain group of pious individuals who were supported by the community. So there were other societies who engaged in this sort of mystical learning and did all these sorts of mitzvos to unlock the sparks in the world to bring the Mashiach, etc., like we talked about. There is a difference, though, which we'll get to, which was that those were really very tight-knit, unique societies of very pious individuals. It wasn't a communal movement in the same way. It wasn't nearly as widespread. But either way, the Hasidim felt, number one, they weren't the ones making all this up. This was the Ari HaKadosh. This was the Derech of the Ari. And they were simply taking the innovations he made and implementing them in a more, you know, widespread, systematic way. And number two, who are you to do this? Well, we have our tzaddikim. We have our Hasidim. And they are special. Our tzaddikim are special. They have a special connection with God. And they have, you know, these incredible visions and dreams. And they have Gilui Eliyahu Anavi. So they're our leaders, and they're the ones that are driving this movement, driving these changes. So we are Someh on them. We follow them. Which raises the question, who deserves religious authority? Which was a lot of what was behind this, that the rabbinic establishment felt this was a deviation from traditional rabbinic authority. Although many of the Hasidim were rabbis and great scholars in their own right, they weren't necessarily part of the rabbinic leadership, you know, of the time. They weren't the Vilna Gaon. And so the charge was made, these aren't the sorts of people, the traditional leaders, who have the right to make these decisions. And to follow them because of their mysticism is not the traditional way to follow a leader. And they felt this was a deviation from traditional and social norms. So that was part of the big question. Who deserves religious authority? The rabbis deserve religious authority if they're not the Rav Ha'ir, if they're not the rabbi of the city? So obviously, the rabbinic establishment and the Misnagdim felt that they know they didn't. And they also felt that by following them, they were disrespecting the other rabbis of the time. So that's definitely part of this. And that gets to the second part, which gets to sort of the egalitarian nature of Hasidus. Hasidus is for everybody by its nature. The notion that God is everywhere and can always be accessed means that to some degree, there's less of a division between the Torah scholar and the lay person, because anybody can access God. And this notion of using these mystical concepts in our prayers, of trying to ascend to higher worlds, that anybody could do, was something new. One second. Sorry, kids here. So that was something that was very controversial at the time. Hey, Miriam. Which was that this notion that just anybody can study Kabbalah or implement this was seen as very controversial. And the feeling was specifically that these people were not really worthy of it. They don't understand it. They're going to misunderstand Kabbalah. And they're going to implement it in ways that are problematic. And that is for not for no reason that they were worried about such a thing, because many of the very problematic movements of the time, such as Sabbateanism and the Frankist movement, were also steeped in Kabbalah. And if you read the Zohar, there's some very challenging concepts there that make anthropomorphisms of God, etc., which if understood inappropriately could potentially lead to heresy. And they were afraid by making Kabbalah so widespread, they were leaving themselves vulnerable to such a reality. So again, part of it is this egalitarianism, making Kabbalah accessible to everybody. They're wasting their time. They don't understand. They should just be learning the rabbinic establishment. And then there's the notion of Torah learning and Torah scholars, right? As you mentioned, Hasidim value Torah learning, but they had their own leaders. And their emphasis on prayer and praying in a different way, in a louder way, maybe with more singing, in a more demonstrative way, was seen as a deviation. And playing for so long, they saw this as, I'm trying to get close to Hashem. They saw this as a renewed movement to bring Mashiach, to bring more of God's influence in the world. But the those who were outside the camp of Hasidus saw this as, what are you doing? This is not the way we daven. This is not the way it's supposed to be done. You're yelling in the middle of Shmona Esrei. What is that? It's not the way you pray. It's not the way you daven. And they saw this as something that was not against the tradition and not the appropriate way to spend time. So, and as you mentioned, there was a certain separatism there, right? The separatism in that, if you're going to have your own prayer book, you're going to have your own minion. So now there's a new minion. So that means you're not going to go to the local minion. You're not going to go to the local shul. What are you going to pay? You're going to pay the rabbi? Are you going to pay the local Rav Ha'ir, the Rav of the city? Or are you going to pay your Rebbe? If you're not going to pay for, if you have your own shkita, you're going to pay the Shochet. Are you going to contribute to all the other communal institutions when you have your own new communal institution? So just like in any other community, when there's a new shul, there's a breakaway minion, there's a lot of politics involved. Because it means you're not supporting the old breakaway minion. We need another one. And things aren't so easy. So that also certainly created a lot of controversy. And finally, there's the reason for suspicion, which was that, as I mentioned, the Sabbateans were highly steeped in Kabbalah in destructive ways. For instance, they, and I don't want to get into, you know, Shabbat's feet too much, but they felt that since Mashiach was coming, there was a new era. And what we have to do is unlock these sparks of spirituality. And one way of doing that is by doing averas, avera lishma. And they would do these horrific sins and they felt that they were redeeming sin in a sense by doing so. And they would even eat on fast days. And they did it because Mashiach is coming. There's a new time and things are changing. And so this was a really dangerous movement. And since that was a mystical movement, so they associated this new Hasidic movement, which is also steeped in mysticism, and suspected them of being followers of Shabtai Tzvi, closet followers of Shabtai Tzvi. So that was the feeling of the rabbinic establishment of the Vilna Gaon, of his followers. These are new rebels. They're breaking tradition. They don't like Talmud. They don't respect Talmidei Chachamim. They don't respect the Halacha. They don't respect Talmud Torah. They're changing everything, and they're gonna be. They're a bunch of heretics. What they're doing with this Kabbalah, and they're saying they're going to all these worlds. They don't know what they're talking about. We had to stop it, and they got very, very fierce. Obviously, the Hasidim did not agree. And obviously, they felt that they were totally in their rights, and they were doing it l'shem shemayim. So I would like to read for you a quote here from Rav Shmuel Shmelka Horowitz of Nicholsburg, who was one of the Hasidic rabbis. And in his response, he writes two quotes here as follows. One is, God-fearing and perfect in following the customs of the Ari, who stand at the height of the universe and receive the tradition of Eliyahu, can one say of them that they are new customs unimagined by our forefathers? How can you say this is new if the Ari HaKadosh didn't? The Ari HaKadosh used to have a Gilei Eliyahu. How can you maintain that what we're doing is against Halacha? We're following the footsteps of great Torah leaders. Number one. Number two, and this is the other point. One who fears God, even though he is not well known, should be allowed to observe God in prayer with all his strength and to be rigorous in any way possible. The fact that a person's not well known, they're not a big, well-known rabbi, shouldn't preclude them from being as enthusiastic in the way they pray and the way observe halacha as they want to be. And why are you putting limits on the way the common Jew should serve God? Who are you to tell me how I should serve Hashem as long as I'm doing it within the confines of halacha? Who are you to tell me how vigorously I should daven? How much time I should spend davening? What sort of kavanos I should have during davening. Be it in his clothing or his offering at the house of the Lord, right? The way I dress, if I'm doing it the same shemayim, who are you to tell me that's wrong? He can do so much, so little, so long as he directs his heart to heaven, right? Echad hamarbe, echad hamamit, belvad shechave libo la shemayim. So that was the response of the Hasidim. And so this was a big, big argument that went on for a pretty long time until already sort of midway through the 19th century started to dwindle down. And what's amazing is nowadays, you don't see it at all. You don't really see it at all. You don't see hardcore misnagdim and Hasidim in the way that we used to. Which begs the question, who won? Who was ultimately right? Who was ultimately right? And it seems, whether the Vilna Gaon was right or not, he didn't win. He did not win. He did not stop the Hasidic movement. And I don't need to make this up, because there are loads of Hasidim out there. That being said, they certainly did influence each other. And the Hasidim that you find today, could you tell that they're so radical or revolutionary? Much of Hasidus today is very traditional and very adherent to all the norms of halacha. And for in many ways today, there is a certain combination of the rabbinic establishment in the ultra-Orthodox world. And so ultimately, we've been influenced by each other. And there's certainly the Hasidim gained influence well beyond the world of Hasidus, even to those who would not define themselves in that way. We know that from the way that a rabbi functions. The way that we daven with the singing, certainly there seems to be some influence there, and vice versa. So what's the takeaway? I think the takeaway, I would say, is as follows. New movements are always very complicated. And there's always going to be new movements. There's always going to be new movements. And those who start a new movement have to be aware that it's not necessarily going to be received so warmly and positively. And they could have the best motivations involved. And they could be convinced that they are following halacha and they have a mesora, they have rabbinic tradition to rely on. But if they're starting something new that runs the risk of seen as separating from the rest of the community and being seen as a threat. And that is a really sensitive thing to be mindful of. But at the same time, and you know, I'm not going to say not all the Hasidim were perfect, and maybe there were Hasidim who went too far, or who broke halacha in certain ways, or who didn't really understand the Kabbalah that they thought they were learning. Maybe that's all true. But when we try to start a movement, we have to also know that sometimes simply saying you're wrong and you're a bunch of kofrim or I'm going to put you in harem doesn't actually stop the movement. And we also have to be careful to know that just because something is new doesn't mean it's wrong or harmful. Sometimes innovation is important and we have to find a way to see if this is innovation. And this is responding to a need in the community that can fit within the confines of halacha. How can we come to terms and unite and work together rather than getting into the vicious disputes the Hasidim Misnadim got into today? So I think we have to be wary of sort of the separatism of saying we're a new group and we're different than you and we're better than you. And, you know, either you're in or you're out, because that's a dangerous thing. But when there is a new movement, to be sensitive to figure out what it is they're responding to or what new revelations they're revealing and how can we incorporate them into our halachic tradition. So we'll leave it today, and Ritz Hashem will continue with some more of the Rebbe.